Hello, I'm Curtis Bowers, and this is Agenda Weekly. Thank you so much for joining me again this week. I really appreciate it. Hope you've had a good week. And I've got a great episode this week for you, and I'll get into that in a minute with Joel Skousen. But before we do, a couple news items I just wanted to talk about. Number one, we have a video below, and it talks about an EMP attack, electromagnetic pulse attack. And let me just read a little bit from this article on it. An electromagnetic pulse from an attack or even from the sun would kill the vast majority of Americans in a short time period by frying all electronics, warned the Congressional EMP Task Force Chief Dr. Peter Vincent Pry in an interview here with Alex Newman. That's the video below. But what's interesting is you learn a lot about what that attack looks like, or if the sun was to do it, which it does regularly in different times in history, just throws off a lot of extra energy, which would do this worldwide, which the electronics worldwide would be gone overnight for everyone. Because he said when the sun does it, it's so much more powerful than even a nuclear weapon doing it. So it's a real risk and a real threat. But he said the amount of money it would take to harden our electrical grid and everything is less than we give in foreign aid to Pakistan each year. And we've never done it. He said it's unbelievable. No president has done it. We've known this is a threat for over 20 years, and we're still totally vulnerable. So anyway, I wanted you to be aware of that and watch that. But the main point he makes is if it were to happen before we harden our grid, he thinks up to as close as 90% of all Americans would die. I mean, that's how serious it is, and our government's doing nothing about it. Also, one other story. One of you sent me an article, another U.S. food processing plant erupts in flames. Just over the last year, almost 100 food processing plants and or farm operations had to have all the livestock killed, whether it was cows or ducks or turkeys or whatever, chickens. But over a year, it's happened 100 times, and the article goes through that. And I just wanted to remind you again, be preparing for the unexpected, because I think the unexpected is long overdue with all that's going on in our country. I can't believe that's an accident. Maybe it is, but it's, as you read through all of them, some days four things have happened where whole herds of animals have had to been killed off because, oh, they might have a virus, and the government comes in and makes them kill all the turkeys or all the chickens or all the ducks. And anyway, it's kind of unbelievable. But be ready, because they're just, whether it's an EMP, whether it's food shortages that look like they're here to stay worldwide, or what we're going to talk about today. The question I'm asking Joel Skousen in the interview to start with was, is World War III just around the corner? And then I talked about, if so, how will we know when it's getting ready to happen? And what are some possible trigger points? And what will it look like in this modern age? And on and on. And he answers all those, but I want to tell you right up front, he said he feels with 100% certainty World War III will happen by 2030. So in 7.5 years. And I said, are you positive? He goes, I've been studying this for 50 years. China and Russia and all that, they've been preparing for this to take us over for 50 years, and they're about 4 years out from having the capabilities and the manpower to be able to do that. So he thinks it's almost certain it will happen by 2030. So anyway, but I think you'll enjoy this and learn a lot. And then he talks about, well, what do we do if that's the case? How can we prepare for that? And anyway, I think you'll learn a lot, but I appreciate you being there. Mr. Skousen, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's good to be with you, Curtis. I guess our families go back quite a ways.
Yes, they do. The circle is small, but it's a tight circle. And yeah. Well, I appreciate you joining me today. We're going to talk about a lot of different things, but I know you've studied this for decades now, have really seen the storm clouds gathering and realizing that a World War III possibility is not only possible, it's a likely scenario. And we're going to talk about that and some other things. Before we get started, those watching, I wanted to let you know one thing about Mr. Skousen. His uncle wrote this book, The Naked Communist. And I know any of you that watch my films and things know that was one of the key things that woke me up as I read that and the goals, and I saw, okay, these people actually have a plan and they're checking off their goals on their plan. I realized it was just very instrumental in me being involved in waking people up and understanding the truth. So, but this is the nephew of Cleon Skousen, which is really neat. And that book influenced my parents back in the early 60s and millions of other people. It's one of the most influential books of the last 100 years, as far as one that shook a generation to understand the threat of communism and that it was serious and that it had the goal of world communism, not just localized.
Curtis, it was also instrumental in my upbringing. I was 17 when I read it. Oh, wow. That's a long time ago. I'm 75 now. Okay. But the thing that I noticed beyond the communist infiltration and conspiracy is that it was very clear that in the State Department, there were people who were non-communist above them who were protecting them and keeping them from being fired. The same thing when Joe McCarthy tried to get rid of and expose all these communists. It turns out from my analysis later on in life that people like Alger Hiss, who the establishment just loved and protected, he's the one who wrote the UN Charter, he was the assistant to Roosevelt, he's the one who got him to sign the Yalta Agreement with the Soviet Union that caused so much damage. I came to the conclusion that he was actually a globalist that joined the Communist Party in order so that when he says he was protecting them and bringing them into the State Department, they wouldn't think anything of it. Oh, he's one of us. But he really wasn't. He was a globalist. You know, the establishment doesn't come out and defend communists to the degree they defended Alger Hiss for years when he was put in prison for perjury, et cetera. The same thing with Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger, when he was in the army in World War II, went over and joined the Communist Party in East Germany. And he did so as a globalist because when he betrayed the U.S. in Vietnam, in the Paris Peace Conference, when he brought in China and gave him a seat on the Security Council, that was part of the negotiated settlement of the Vietnam War. Why that was part of it, nobody knows. But the communists then wouldn't think anything of it. Oh, he's one of us. But he wasn't. He's a globalist. And that's what conservatives have failed to understand for so many years, that the globalists use communism to break down the world, the social order, to create conflict so that they come in and with their milder form of socialism, Fabian socialism, you own it, but we control it, that people will be disarmed. And that's a very key point of understanding.
Why don't you start with, just for people that maybe don't have as much of a background in this, tell what really happened when the Soviet Union dissolved. What was that all about?
Well, you know, Christopher Story of the UK and myself in the United States were the only two that blew the whistle on the fall of the Soviet Union, that it was a carefully crafted deception, that the Communist Party just went underground, that the Soviet Union did not, in fact, collapse. Now, it's true that the Soviet Union was having real problems with their communist form of lifestyle and control. They were getting behind in the arms races. So they faked their own demise in order to get aid in trade. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, as I was a small-time analyst, at the geopolitical analyst at the time, and for me to be able to see through it, I knew very clearly that the globalists in our government knew that it was phony, too. But they went along with it because they have had this program of supporting Russia and China for many, many years, giving them weapons and transferring technology. They're building enemies, and we'll get into that later in terms of because why they need another world war. But Erich Honecker, the dictator of East Germany, said on his deathbed, you know, after he fled Europe and went to Chile, on his deathbed, he admitted that Moscow gave him orders to let the protest in Leipzig go forward, the student protest. And to this day, the people who were student protesters said, where were the Stasi? Every time we ever had to try to meet him, there were infiltrators and we'd get arrested and the Stasi were nowhere to be seen. The same thing with the protest in Red Square, where Yeltsin was broadcasting on television, which was still controlled by the Communist Party, and they let that broadcast go forward. Sitting on top of that tank and broadcasting about the new revolution, the Russian student protesters were saying, where's the KGB? You know, they're just nowhere to be seen. Somebody told them to stand down, and that's part of the phony fall of the Soviet Union. In addition, when you look at the background of the people like Mikhail Gorbachev, he was a mid-level arms negotiator 2 years before he was premier. So you know there was somebody behind the scenes that picked him, because you don't rise in the communist hierarchy without killing people, you know, like Khrushchev rose to power and like Stalin rose to power. And then there was the phony thing about the phony or the failed coup, where the KGB apparently failed to arrest Gorbachev in his undefended villa. Now, the KGB have overthrown many, many governments, and we're to believe that they couldn't capture Gorbachev in his undefended villa. And then, because of the failed coup, we're to believe that the heads of the KGB, the GRU, which is the military intelligence, and the Defense Department all fled for their lives. Now, how does the heads of the KGB, the GRU, and the Defense and the military police flee for their lives? These are the people supposedly having all power within the Soviet Union. Who do they flee from? Well, nobody asked those questions. You know, the media was absolutely silent. In any case, the wall came down and everyone, and even the media, gave Ronald Reagan credit. This was their way of hooking the conservatives into believing in the phony fall of the Soviet Union. I mean, that was our hero. Ronald Reagan did it, but he didn't do it. I mean, I applaud Reagan for telling Gorbachev to tear down this wall, but it played very well into their playbook. So Western aid and trade flowed into the Soviet Union. They rebuilt almost the entire economy. They rebuilt the entire oil industry in Russia, making them the highest output after Saudi Arabia and bringing them millions of dollars. They used to send out of Kennedy Airport a weekly trunk full of $100 bills as cash to pay off the Russian people for supposedly coming to peace. And that's why the Russian oligarchs, when they went to Europe, they only had $100 bills to give for tips. They didn't have any 10s or 20s. They only had hundreds because of the largesse of the U.S. sending them this cash bonus. Now, about the original oligarchs, these are the people who I believe were like Boris Berezovsky and Guzinski and Khodorkovsky, etc. These, I believe, were the true leaders of the Soviet Union behind the Politburo. These are the ones who picked Gorbachev to run this phony fall of the Soviet Union. How do I know that? Because they came out from hiding, so to speak, or from the background, and they became the wealthiest people in Russia. Now, how did they become the wealthiest? Well, they had apparently told the State Bank of the Soviet Union to loan them the money to buy up Gazprom and to buy up the oil industry and buy up the media for Guzinski, et cetera. Well, who has the authority under this chaos of the Soviet Union to order the State Bank to give them a loan? Well, obviously the people that they recognized as the real communist leaders in Russia. And so Boris Berezovsky became the head of the Commonwealth of Independent States. And one of my contacts in the Kremlin noticed one day when Berezovsky came in and Yeltsin and all the other bigwigs were going to have a meeting, Yeltsin stepped aside and let Boris Berezovsky enter the room first. Now that, in a hierarchical sense, means Yeltsin recognized him as the supreme leader. Well, Yeltsin was a drunk, and Yeltsin eventually had to be done away with because he was incompetent. He was just a puppet to begin with. And so they brought in a colonel from the KGB, Vladimir Putin. And Vladimir Putin had met with Boris Berezovsky in his villa in Spain 5 times in the year that he ascended to the presidency. That means that Boris Berezovsky was calling the shots and that Putin was his man. But Putin eventually turned against the original oligarchs. He locked up Khodorkovsky. He exiled Guzinski to Israel, who was a Jew, and he had Berezovsky assassinated in London. Now, that tells you now that, and by the way, Putin has allowed a new set of oligarchs to rise who will owe their wealth and their position to Vladimir Putin because he protects them. And in exchange, I'm told by insider sources that he gets a 4% cut of their annual income. That makes Putin the wealthiest man in the world. And that gold-plated palace in Sochi that was filmed in the Sochi Olympics, that belongs to Vladimir Putin, even though he denies it. All the yachts that he has are owned by other people. You know, it's a very crafty deception. But right now, and that's why the war in Ukraine is significant in terms of the fall, you have to understand that Putin's intent is to reestablish the Soviet Union prior to World War III. And key to that is taking back Ukraine, which had all the industrial power, the breadbasket of Europe, all the wheat supplies that Russia desperately needs Ukraine to do that. And so that's a brief scenario of why and how the phony fall of the Soviet Union took place.
No, that's great. Okay, that's a key player, obviously. Now give us an overview of China, kind of their last history, last 30 years, and then what kind of threat they are today.
Going back to World War II, you know, China was allies of the West against Japan through Chiang Kai-shek, who had overthrown many of the original chiefs and the corruption that has always been in China. But then the Soviet Union began to build up the Communist Party in China, and the head of that was Mao Zedong. Well, Mao Zedong was losing badly the civil war with Chiang after the end of World War II. And so the globalists in the United States, chief of which was George Catlett Marshall, who ran World War II on behalf of the United Nations. Eisenhower worked under General Marshall. So when he became Secretary of State, he demanded that Chiang Kai-shek enter into a coalition government with Mao Zedong. Well, anyone who knows the communist history knows that you don't enter into a coalition government with a communist because they end up assassinating you and taking over. So he refused. And in response, George Catlett Marshall cut off all military aid to Chiang Kai-shek. Now, traditional history says Chiang Kai-shek was a corrupt leader and he didn't have the support of his troops and they abandoned him and fled to the communists. Well, the truth is when you cut off all the ammunition and arms to an army and you know you're facing an onslaught because the Soviet Union was pouring in arms and ammunition, of course the people are gonna flee when you're out of ammunition, et cetera. That's the real reason George Catlett Marshall was completely responsible for the bringing of China to power. Now, I might say that at the end of World War II, the globalists and Alger Hiss in Truman and Roosevelt administrations brought in Owen Lattimore and a lot of other communists. And they, through the tail end, continued to give lend-lease to the Soviet Union after the end of World War II. Out of the Air Force Base in Montana, where all the lend-lease would fly over Siberia to deliver to Russia, the man in charge, he saw that the Soviets were shipping through the Lend-Lease a bunch of great big black trunks, huge black trunks. And he was very suspicious about them. And so he broke diplomatic immunity, opened the trunks and found out they contained the plans to the nuclear bomb, the rest of the plans that they couldn't steal through the Manhattan Project. So he calls the White House. And he talks to Owen Lattimore, and Lattimore says, give them back to the Soviet Union, close them up, and don't ever tell anybody what you saw. And of course, he wrote a book about it, about what he saw, and it never got any press.
Was that Major Jordan's diaries?
That's correct. Major Jordan's diary. Yes, thank you. So they're very, very important of what he did. But you see, the other thing that they shipped through Lend-Lease was the first shipment of enriched uranium to the Russians. They didn't know how to enrich uranium. So they had the plans, but they didn't know how to enrich uranium. And so the U.S. shipped them their first batch of enriched uranium so that they could explode a nuclear bomb in 1949 and became a nuclear power. And they immediately began to share that with China, which has taken a lot longer to develop their nuclear weapons. But you see, this goes to the principle of the Cleon, my uncle, wrote in The Naked Capitalist, because he too became aware that the capitalists, they weren't really capitalists, they were socialists who had made themselves wealthy through capitalism, and they were in league with government. They were globalists, to be sure, and they were giving aid and to Soviet Union and China. As late as the Nixon administration, a Republican administration, we chose Henry Kissinger, a globalist, to be his national security advisor. He gave the Russians the miniature ball bearing machinery that had never been transferred because it was sensitive military technology. Russia could not MIRV their warheads, meaning multiple independent reentry vehicles. They couldn't have multiple warheads because they required these miniature gyros, which they couldn't build without this miniature ball bearing machinery. And Kissinger gave it to them. So clear back then, you know, and all through, even during the Reagan administration, unbeknownst to Reagan, the Commerce Department, Clinton administration, Commerce Department was shoveling out technology to China. And then when the Congress finally got wind of that and they stopped that, then the deep state made a deal with Israel, where Israel was allowed to share all the technology the U.S. was sharing with Israel and share it with China, or sell it to China and make money out of it. So this is a very evil thing. It makes Anthony Sutton's book about Wall Street and the rise of Hitler look just very, very parallel.
Yeah. So now that that's happened, where we built up the Soviet Union so they'd have nuclear weapons, so we'd have to build our weapons and all that. And then China has received all that too. Today, what do you tell me about China today? What the threat, the reality of who they are and what they're trying to do?
Well, Russia and China are temporarily allied in order to take down the West. And I can get into that more about what we've learned about in the war of Ukraine. But even Russia now is leery of China because China is getting stronger and is stronger in terms of manpower and conventional weapons than China, than Russia is. So Russia has stopped sharing its top-of-the-line technology with China. That shows you that Russia itself knows that China is intending to strike them after they conquer the West. But we have never had any inspection of the nuclear program of China, and they've never been party to any of the nuclear disarmament treaties, which the Russians cheated on, every single one of them. And of course, you know, the Biden administration, the Obama administration wanted to do a tripartite disarmament agreement between Russia, the U.S., and China. And then China says, no, I'm sorry, we're not interested. You know, it's like three gunfighters facing off in the street, and two of them say, let's hand down our weapons, and the third one says, no. You know, just really stupid to enter into a disarmament agreement when the third one, but even if you could believe the communists, which you can't. Right. So the communist Chinese have over 3,000 miles of underground tunnels, of which all of their nuclear assembly and missile assembly factories are underground and pretty safe from, you know, attack from even nuclear weapons. And they are beginning to build over 300 silos in missile fields similar to the ones that we have. I'm a little bit skeptical of that, whether or not it's true that they plan on putting their missiles in silos, because it's not a good strategy what the Russians do, and putting them on rails and having them, you know, moving all the time makes them incapable of being targeted. But if you have fixed silos, you can target them. I don't know if they're going to actually put missiles in those silos that they're building, but, you know, even having underground tunnels for China is a problem, because the U.S. could target the entrance to those tunnels so that nobody could get out. The missile trains could not get out of the tunnels. So having a racetrack pattern out on the Chinese desert is probably the best way to do it. They have some of that, but not as extensive as the Soviet Union. The big threat that how China became a threat, by the way, is because the globalists knew that China needed to have money to build up their military. You know, even though they were transferring technology, they didn't have the commercial technology to manufacture a lot of the sophisticated things involved in military weapons. And that's why, first of all, Kissinger gave China a seat in the United Nations and threw Taiwan out, gave it a seat on the Security Council, which means your enemy has a veto, just like Russia. I mean, that really tells you that they're not doing anything in the in the interest of the United States and in liberty. And then it took Newt Gingrich and the so-called conservative contract with America to get elected. And the first thing he did was nothing about the contract with America, was to give World Trade Organization entrance to China so that they could have most favored nation status. And then that's what started the entire flow of American industry to China. Not so much because it had unlimited labor and it was cheaper, but it was much less regulation. I mean, the regulatory atmosphere in the U.S. to build a new factory with high tech and other things, and the labor costs and the union threats, and all of that went away when you went to China. And that's what the big lure was, to go to China. And so a lot of the business community in the United States bought into the idea that China had moderated, that it was no longer communist because it was, semi-capitalist. But of course, just like the phony fall of the Soviet Union, they were feigning moderation so that they could get more and more, and they would require that you turn over all your technological secrets to them as a condition of doing business in China. And in the process, 80% now of our consumer goods in the United States are produced in China. And so they're relatively immune to the same kind of sanctions that they put on Russia, because it would really hurt American supply chain. And it already is. I mean, that's part of the reason for shutting down Shanghai, not for one or two cases of COVID, because they wanted to hurt the American supply chains and economy. Not so much that they actually stopped buying Chinese, but in fact, there are several, there's over 50 companies now that are starting to rebuild factories in Mexico or the United States and getting out of China, because they know that eventually we're going to have a major supply problem. So China is a real threat. It's a larger threat, in fact, in the Soviet Union in terms of conventional weaponry, because they've got potential of 20 million man army. The Russians have shown in Ukraine that they don't have a good conventional weapon system. But what Russia shines in, it's got the largest nuclear capacity in the world. And, the U.S. has a measly 420-some missiles are left of the Minuteman III. We've taken off the three warheads, and there's only a single warhead now on each missile. And Russia has the new Sarmat II. They have the Sarmat missile. They have, and these things have 15 warheads, maneuvering warheads on it, and we have a single warhead. So they far, far outweigh. But the reason, and this is what we've learned from Ukraine, the reason that Russia cannot and will not attack the United States or the West or NATO with nuclear weapons is they do not have the conventional military power to consolidate the gains. How do you occupy? You can't even occupy Ukraine, let alone all of Europe or the United States. So why nuke them? That would just allow them to get mad and rebuild and eventually come back and kill you. So I've said in my world affairs brief, there's not going to be a nuclear strike of Russia onto the United States or NATO until they're ready to join with China, because they need China's conventional capacity to consolidate the gains of a nuclear weapon strike.
That's a good overview. No, it's so being that's the situation. I know I've listened to several of your lectures on this, that you feel like World War III is a serious possibility. So why do you think that's going to happen, and what is it going to look like?
Okay. Good question, Curtis. As an introduction to that, there are three predator centers in the world. In my opinion, all run by Satan through his influence, and he's promising all three that they're going to win, but only one's going to win. And the three predator centers are the Anglo-American globalists. The deep state is their enforcement arm. That's what we deal with. Then there's the Russians and the Chinese. Russians and Chinese are temporarily allied, even though they know they're going to have to go at it themselves someday. But here's why World War III is inevitable. Number one, the globalists have always used war to get us into a global government. World War III was a contrived war in order to get us into the League of Nations, and it failed. And so the Treaty of Versailles was so onerous on Germany, it guaranteed that they would go to war again, which they did in World War II. In World War II, we got the United Nations. In fact, we know from documents in the White House that they were using the term United Nations 2 years before it was actually formed in 1945. Alger Hiss, the globalist, wrote the Constitution of the United Nations, but it didn't have military power, it didn't have police power, and it didn't have taxing power, regulatory power. So they need one more war to get us into a global government. Now, COVID was a conspiracy to take away liberty, to get us used to living under emergency orders, but it doesn't get you into a global government. In fact, with the distrust of Americans and British over global government, that's what Brexit was all about. And by the way, the conservative government of Boris Johnson and Theresa May betrayed the Brexit. The actual agreement that they signed gave away most of the rights that they were pretending in the Brexit. So the globalists are very sneaky, and they will use conservatives, they will use Republicans, they will use, the supposed opposition, Rhino Republicans, to give it that. But they need a war to do it. COVID doesn't do it. It doesn't form, even though they're trying to have a global health pandemic mandate from the WHO, because of the protests of the smaller states, they had to shelve that. Now, they haven't given up on that. They've just shelved it temporarily. But war will give us everything. And it has to be a war sufficiently severe and damaging to the United States that our globalist leaders can come out of their bunkers and say, we have to join a militarized global government and create a militarized global in order to prosecute the war. And here's how this is going to happen. The United States in 1997 signed, under the Clinton administration, a completely new nuclear posture review, or it was a nuclear strategy. And they dumped the Reagan strategy, which was a nuclear policy. It was the official policy of the United States to win a nuclear war, to prepare. The military had to prepare to win a nuclear war. And that primary way of winning a nuclear war is launch on warning. Our satellites detect launches from Russia and China, and we launch our missiles so that their missiles hit empty silos and our missiles hit live targets. So launch on warning is a very powerful deterrent to a nuclear war. So in 1997, the United States created PDD 60, Presidential Decision Directive 60, in which it dictated to our missile forces to absorb a nuclear first strike and retaliate afterwards. General Butch Neal of the Marine Corps, when he heard about it, said, retaliate with what? Well, we still have our missile submarines, right? No, in 1997, Bill Clinton came out and said, as a gesture of goodwill to the Soviet Union, to show them that we are not a threat, we're going to order 50% of our submarines, half of them, to be imported at any one time to make them more vulnerable as a gesture of goodwill. Suicidal policy. Now, you've got to remember, too, and we've lost two of those missiles. We only have 14 now. And let's suppose seven are still available for deployment or out in the ocean when this happens. The warheads on our ballistic missile submarines are small warheads. They are not capable of hitting hardened targets. And so you can't win a nuclear war because Russia and China both have hardened military targets where most of their missile and cruise missile and ballistic missiles and nuclear factories are underground. So what PDD 60 indicated to me when I heard about it was that, this is suicide. Why would the globalists do this? And then it dawned on me, they want to decapitate the U.S. military. And they know that the Russians and Chinese do not intend to strike U.S. cities. They don't want to destroy the infrastructure. They don't want to destroy the economies that they depend on. They want to simply decapitate the military and blackmail us into submission. And the U.S. has spies in both Russia and China. They know about this policy. So it fulfills two purposes. One, it gets the first strike decapitates the U.S. military, and then our own government can come out of their bunkers. They're not telling you this strike is coming, but they know it's coming, and they want it, because that's the only way you get Americans into a global government, is decapitating the military. So by decapitating them, they come out and say, look, we didn't know this was going to happen, which is a lie, just like 9/11. And the only way we can prosecute this war is to join together with other European nations, Western nations, in a militarized global government. And who's going to say nay? Nobody. It's just like 9/11. Everybody bowed down and, oh, war on terror, and we've got to go out and, you know, attack Afghanistan and Iraq, even though they had nothing to do. 9/11 was a deep state operation from beginning to end. So I believe the U.S. is being set up to absorb a nuclear first strike, and the result will be an automatic getting us into a, we lose our liberty. That's where we get into a global government. And once you're in a global government, you never get out. They never take no for an answer. So because Russia and China are building the massive weapons of mass destruction, because the globalists want this war, and because of PDD 60, I am 100% certain, not just to the possibility, it's a certainty, we'll see a nuclear war with Russia and China before the end of this decade. And I don't think it will be earlier. I think it's going to be in the latter half. That's the best I can guess, because Russia and China have to be ready. And Russia clearly isn't ready in conventional warfare. And China still isn't ready. They're still building aircraft carriers. They're still building. They're the ones who've got to have the blue water navy to occupy other countries. You can't just nuke people. You've got to send a navy and millions of troops to occupy until people give in and agree to be controlled. And so it is a few years away. That means we do have time to prepare. But don't believe that Trump getting reelected is going to save us. He's clueless about conspiracy. He's never studied conspiracy. He wants to save America, but he doesn't know how. He can't tell who's deep state and who isn't deep state. So how can he drain the swamp?
Yeah. No, I know he loves our country and everything, but that's what I noticed too. I was like, he doesn't read, which, as he'll admit, no, I don't read. So if you don't read, you're in trouble, because you're going to just be getting the propaganda line.
The briefings. He lives by briefings. Even in his business, it's brief me, brief me.
Yes.
So if it isn't in a briefing and it isn't in Fox News, he watches flight. But they will never talk conspiracy at Fox News. So he's never going to learn about it.
No. So that's, you know, well, a couple of things there before my next question is that it was interesting. One, so China building those 300 silos, say they're just empty, but we don't know that. So if we even did, when we only have 425 or whatever weapons, that's nothing in a war. So we're almost neutered right there. But then what about this? This just popped into my mind as you were talking. I feel it's always been one of our greatest strengths, but just the way the American people are so armed. I always felt like in the 70s when Jimmy Carter was there, I thought, man, the Soviet Union could take us now. I was just a teenager, but my family was into this. And my dad said, I think they could, because he'd probably surrender. But he goes, they know the American people won't surrender. And so it's kind of it's a deterrent, because you're like, how do we take on these people that are well armed? But anyway, do you think that's even a little piece, and maybe why they're going after the guns right now? Because you can't have 40, 50 million people that are armed well. I know, even though it's against war, military weapons, but.
Well, my answer to that is it's only a defense against occupation by a former country. That's a recipe for guerrilla warfare. When you have over a trillion arms in private hands in the United States, nobody wants to occupy a country with over a trillion arms unless they move into Chicago or New York, where people don't have enough weapons. But they don't want to get out in the countryside and tangle with the former military vets and things in the United States. But remember, Russia and China don't want to occupy. They want to nuke the military so they can blackmail the West into submission. And if they don't occupy, who do you use your arms against? Your own government, you see, who is implementing the New World Order, the globalist mandates. That's the problem, is that you say, well, we've agreed and our government has got us into this New World Order, so we are bound, you see. Our constitution doesn't mean it's been overridden by the new EU or the global constitution. And so our own people will be enforcing on us. And if they, I don't believe, in fact, they'll actually confiscate guns until this war starts. Then there'll be real martial law. That's part of the COVID thing, getting people used to living under false emergency orders. But when there's a nuclear war and decapitation of the military, believe me, there'll be martial law, and people will be, you know, I was very disappointed how many Americans were subservient to these stupid COVID restrictions, the masks and the social, the stupidity of all that. How few people saw through that, even conservatives feeling like there's a patriotic duty to wear a mask. I was very disappointed.
No, it was a great testing ground to see how much will these people submit when we have no authority to do this, and most did. Yeah, it was shocking. I was shocked, especially when you read the medical studies on masks don't do anything, and 6 feet is ridiculous. A virus will go wherever it wants to go. But yeah, when you saw that and everyone still submitted, you realize they've done what they wanted. They've dumbed us down where we're sheep. And we just, oh, well, what am I supposed to do? That's why the schools have had a key role in this, making a population that is just not, you know, like they should be. Okay, so with all that being, what do you think would be a likely trigger point to where we would see something happening and go, okay, this is probably getting ready to happen?
Well, it's not going to be Ukraine. As I say, Russia cannot, even though they threatened the use of nuclear weapons, they can't pull that off. They don't have any way to consolidate the use. They've got to wait, first of all, for the trigger event till China is ready. And I think it's somewhere in the latter half of the decade, China will be ready. Now, they need a trigger event. They are going to take down the bully of the world. That was part of the reason for doing 9/11, was not only to create a phony war on terror, but to justify the U.S. going into the Middle East and getting a very strong hatred by the Muslims. And we have, that hatred is really there now. We are the bully of the world. And part of that was the globalists wanting to give Russia and Chinese an excuse to finally attack the U.S. We're taking down the bully of the world. Okay. But they still need a trigger event. They can't just do it because they think, hey, we're going to nuke you. That trigger event, I believe, most likely is going to be South Korea, North Korea attacking South Korea. North Korea has already said they will use nuclear weapons in North Korea if the U.S. tries to stop them from taking the South. They said they will use nuclear weapons against the U.S. if the U.S. intervenes against China and tries to take Taiwan or stop China from taking Taiwan. So you see, that's the trigger event is... a nuclear threat by North Korea. Now, remember, unlike Taiwan, unlike Ukraine, the U.S. has to intervene in South Korea. It has to intervene because we've got 47,000 troops there. We have to intervene. And so you see, and we have to intervene strong enough to counter 60,000 artillery tubes blasting Seoul. And we have to counter a 1 million-man army. South Korea has a 50,000-man army. I think the U.S. may have to use tactical nuclear weapons in order to stop the overwhelming North Korean military invasion of South Korea. If they do that, because North Korea is a puppet state of China, China can easily say, you know, we're coming in and, you know, you started this nuclear war, you use tactical nukes, and then they'll nuke. And so if you see a war in South Korea come, I think we'll be in World War III within 2 to 3 weeks. And that war will start, by the way, with an EMP strike on the United States and possibly Europe. It takes 8 or 9 EMP weapons to blanket the grid, not just one. So only Russia and China have the capacity to do that. And if that happens, there'll be no electricity, no TV, no radio, nothing, you know, for a period of time. In fact, I think the grid will be down for almost a year, because the long distance transformers that we use to transform the thousands of volts down to usable 240 volts are all made in China, and we don't stockpile any in the United States. So how do you rebuild the grid? You know, if those transformers will all be fried when that happens.
Well, I'm sure our enemies will be happy to still make them quickly for us and send them over. It's unbelievable. It is unbelievable. We enemies have been in charge of our country for so long. It just makes you so frustrated.
But remember, they're not communists. They are globalists.
Globalists. No, no, that's...
They want this war. And even though they'll protest, you know, they're not going to warn you. They're building new and modern deep underground bunkers, but they're not warning the Americans to do that.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. The globalists that have the wealth, they're using the communists to do the dirty work, it makes sense that's how they would do that. Boy, well, so much interesting, great stuff. I'll need to have you on again soon and talk about some other issues. But I want, before we're done here, I want you to talk a little bit about how do you prepare for this? And I'm going to just show a few of your books that I have. Here is Strategic Relocation. Maybe talk a little bit about what some of the things this book covers and how that fits into us preparing the best we can with what we have to endure something like we just talked about.
Okay. Well, the purpose of writing Strategic Relocation was, frankly, and I've got a section on this, on war and the threat of war, was because I knew this war was coming, and it's going to be important. Just like in COVID, the restrictions really were, and the lockdowns occurred in the big cities. Hardly anything occurred in the rural areas. In fact, in rural Utah, where I am, you hardly ever saw a mask, except if you go into a woke corporation like Walmart, which required it for a period of time. So just like in nuclear war, et cetera, and an EMP strike, your greatest enemy is going to be population density. You do not want to be in a major metro when that happens. And most people live in a major metro or near it, okay? So this is a problem. That means you either have to prepare a retreat strategy to get out of the big cities. And then the question is, how do I get out in time? Well, that's one of the reasons why I published the World Affairs Brief, where I track this threat all of the time, including the war threat. And it's written from an aspect of conspiracy, what the deep state is not telling you in their control of the media. So I'm hoping to at least give my subscribers to the World Affairs Brief a heads up when I see it. But nevertheless, one of the great blessings, by the way, of this war and the EMP strike that will precede it by about 20 minutes is that Christians and good conservatives are in the big cities now because of jobs. When that happens, the jobs are going to be gone. You're never going back to the Mad Max scenario of the big cities. You're going to retreat, and whether beforehand, if you're wise, or at least move to the outskirts of the city so that you don't get blocked in by these major traffic jams that will happen when all the electricity goes out. But I believe, and my hope is, that we'll have new communities of conservative majorities in rural areas that will be able to at least protest the globalist mandates and the globalist types of things. I frankly do not believe we'll ever win back our liberty as a nation, because the people are now so corrupt, and through public schools, the young people are so corrupt now that LGBTQ nonsense is just taking over the youth and the nation. It's just, this war is going to separate us out from the big cities. And that's where my hope is, that we will have some protection there. So you really need to prepare to relocate because of this war scenario and the control that is there. And I cover every state of the union in Strategic Relocation. I tell all the pros and cons of the gun laws, the medical freedom laws, homeschooling laws, all of that type of the pollution, the government, the corruption of each state. I rate every state, and some states have a zero rating, and no state has a five-star rating anymore. Utah and Idaho used to be five-star, but even they've gone down because of the Rhino Republican governors going along with COVID. And only Ron DeSantis is fighting it to a certain extent. And unfortunately, he's in a zero rated state of Florida, because without electricity, you know, and in a war, you don't want to be in a state where you have only two roads leading out of the state. It's just
And that's exactly, a lot of people that have been watching this Agenda Weekly, a couple weeks ago, we had an episode on preparing for 2030. Not even necessarily the war scenario, but this is so vital as just the World Economic Forum and what all the globalists are trying to do by 2030, they're working in earnest towards that. And so I had the same advice. You got to get out. You got to get rural. You got to get self-sufficient. You got to be in a local, small community of like-minded people. And that people watching this, I know that's a big decision, but you'll find that life is there as one is a lot less expensive, but it's simpler. You have more time for family, for things that are important, investing in the next generation and preparing for whatever may come. And so I want to encourage you to do that too. Now, the World Affairs Brief, tell them how they can subscribe to that.
Well, the World Affairs Brief comes out every Friday. And I've been publishing since the year 2000, so 22 years without missing an issue. If you go to worldaffairsbrief.com and click on request a sample on the left-hand side, you'll get the current brief, and it tells you how to subscribe. It's only about $1 a week, $48 a year. And you can subscribe for a month. You can, you know, just as a trial issue, and you get that sample, et cetera. But I recommend people try it because you'll see that, you know, even though I was in favor of Donald Trump because I realized he was sincere, I did expose all the errors that he made because he just didn't have the background,
right,
you know, to be able to detect the deep state. You know, he threw out James Comey and then put in Christopher Wray, who's deep state.
Yeah.
You know, even Brett Kavanaugh's deep state, even though he was a conservative jurist that Trump put in the Supreme Court, he was number two to Ken Starr in the Vince Foster murder cover-up, calling it a suicide. And so, you know, and that's why Kavanaugh has been voting with John Roberts against us so often, you know, because he's deep state.
Yeah, no, that's, and it's excellent. I've read many, many issues. My son-in-law is a subscriber. But those of you watching, I know a lot of you are the kind that love to learn, love to understand. That's why you watch this. And that's another great, inexpensive resource to have, just to be able to share with neighbors and friends so they start to see, oh, there's things going on. Because that's one of the most influential things you can do is just influence one person at a time. Where then once they get it, they see the cover-ups, they see what's going on. It just frees one more person from the narrative, and then we have one more person on our side. So always remember, that's significant, even if it's just one person that you wake up. One other book I have of yours, The Secure Home, you can talk about that for a second, or any of the other books, but how they tie in to, again, things people can be doing right now to kind of prepare for the coming years and what may happen.
Well, let me just say this: there's two books about security. One is The Secure Home, which covers everything in preparedness, from solar to generators to cisterns to bulletproof walls, windows, doors, anything, you know, and everything in between. You don't have to, you can pick what you need, and it's geared to the do-it-yourselfer. You know, I'm a great believer that when you do a safe room and a fallout shelter, which you're all going to need, by the way, because even though you may not be in a major nuclear target, and I list the nuclear targets in strategic relocation, nevertheless, you're going to get fallout everywhere in the United States, unless you're on the left coast of Oregon, Washington, California. You don't want to be there because those are leftist controlled states, but you won't have any gun rights when you need them, et cetera. But everywhere else in the United States, you need fallout protection because the air flows from west to east in the United States. The smaller book that I have is called the High Security Shelter Book. If you've got a home with an existing basement, putting a safe room in an existing basement and concealing it is the cheapest way to get that done. And Secure Home is for remodeling, new construction. All of the architectural details are in there. As well. So those are the two different, they cover two different areas. But remember, and I want to end with this basic philosophy thing. Conservatives realize that it's tough to retreat. It's tough to have a second home, or it's tough to move. You just want to remember, even though as tough as it will be to change jobs and move and get out of the big cities, think what happens once an EMP strike comes. Your job is gone. There's no electricity. You can't get out. You're having to walk, or, you know, the choice is yours. What I'm just saying is difficult as it will never be easier than it is right now to make a decision to relocate and secure your home. You'll never, you know, inflation's going to get worse. Supply chain's going to get worse. In fact, in strategic relocation, I do a lot of consultation with people, for an hourly rate, and people complain now, I can't get to the best states now. All the Californians are moving in and the prices are there's nothing about, and it's right. It's almost too late to get to the best places. That doesn't mean, you know, I can find good places in almost any state if you get rural enough and off the beaten path. But remember this generally, as long as you promise someone a savior, and I'm not talking about Jesus Christ, I'm talking about Donald Trump, they won't prepare. As long as they think that someone's going to save us, someone's going to get back to make America great again, they won't prepare. I'm here to tell you, it won't happen. If Donald Trump gets reelected, which won't happen, by the way, he won't get reelected. He would never save us. It's still going to happen. The globalists controlled him and manipulated and maneuvered him because he's subject to the flattery. So remember this. Don't depend on an earthly savior. We're going to go through war, and you got to prepare. And the sooner you do it, as tough as it is now, because of inflation and other things, it's still easier than if you wait until the EMP and the war comes.
Yeah, no, that's exactly. I've made that exact point many times on here. I go, it's up to us. No one's doing anything. We always hope it's somebody else, so we don't have to do anything. But if you don't do it, no one else is taking care of your family except you. So you have to do these things. You have to think about them and pray about them and just see what your options are. I know different people have different options based on finances and things, but at least these are good things to be thinking about, praying about, talking to family about, and then digging into good books like these to start to look around. What if we were going to move, where would we move? And what would be the opportunities there and stuff? So you can start to, again, plan now. It's too late. Like the old saying I always bring up, better 7 years early than 7 minutes late from World War II. I mean, it's just key. That's what they said in World War II. But once it's too late. It's, oh, I wish I would have, but it's over. So be thinking about these things. Mr. Skousen, I appreciate you so much being on here. I appreciate all the things you've done to stand up for truth, for our liberties, you and your family. And I appreciate that greatly. My children appreciate that greatly. And I appreciate your time tonight. And where these books and all your other resources, is it the same website or what's the best website?
Well, there are two websites, worldaffairsbrief.com for the website, but you can get to joelskousen.com for the books.
Okay.
At World Affairs Brief, but you can go directly and they're on Amazon, but I'd prefer you not patronize Amazon. Just get them from my website,
yes.
joelskousen.com. Skousen is Skousen.
Yeah, and I'll put it on the screen. We'll have all that. But again, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Well, I hope you appreciated that interview. I know there was a lot of sobering content, but we can't bury our heads in the sand. If these things are really going on and they're a real threat and they have a high probability of happening, we need to be aware of that, and we need to be prepared, and we need to do the things we can do, and the things we can't do, we pray about, and let God worry about that. But it's sobering days in which we live, and we know that. That's why you watch Agenda Weekly. That's why I do this, because I know every week things are changing, and things are happening worldwide, and the threat to our freedoms and the threat to those that are Christians is growing every day. Evil is just rearing its ugly head and seeking to snuff out anyone speaking truth, anyone standing for the truth, anyone that wants to protect their own families from the evil influences. That's considered evil nowadays. Well, we must stand and we're going to stand, but I appreciate you being there. Our verse for this week is the same one from last week because it was a two-part verse, but here it is, Romans 8. 38 and 39. It's perfect for a sobering topic like we just had because we need to remember this when we just heard World War III might be just around the corner. Listen to this. For I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, no matter what comes, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. That should comfort us. Nothing can separate us from His love. So will we go through hard times? Maybe. But He'll be there with us in the midst of those hard times. And He'll be using us if we're prepared, if we have courage, and if we're willing to just stand for what is right, He will use us. And that's a great promise. I appreciate you all very much. Keep praying for our country. Keep praying for peace. Keep praying for each of us individually to know clearly what God would have us to be doing in the particular place He's placed us. And that You raise those children and grandchildren to love and fear God. And until next week, God bless you.